Good morning, and welcome to another of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute's Distinguished Lecture Series. The Osher Institute presents approximately 40 classes each quarter for music, finance, literature, writing workshops, sciences, and technology. You can visit our website at olli@ucsd.edu. Now it is my pleasure to introduce the curriculum chairperson, Dan Dinan. Dan.
Thank you very much, Dan. Our distinguished lecturer today is a favorite of ours here at UCSD, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. He's been a guest many times. You can say what you want about Micah Gehry, but you can never say he's dull. He's always feisty, he's provocative, and he never fails to be challenging. He allegedly once told the New York Times that my ability to annoy people is almost unlimited. And not many city officials would disagree with that. We look forward, Mike, to a fascinating session this morning, and we hope that you will save some time later for questions and answer period after your opening remarks. Micah Gehry is a lifelong San Diegan. He has a Bachelor of Science degree from Arizona State, and he earned his law degree at UC Berkeley. He holds a master's degree in public administration from Harvard. In building a successful private practice, Mike recovered more than a quarter of a billion dollars, that's with a B, for victims of pensions and stock fraud. He has prevailed in damage actions against many powerful corporations. In the public sector, he had a distinguished career as an assistant U.S. attorney here in San Diego, and he directed a grand jury probe of pension racketeering. His success resulted in his appointment as assistant counsel for the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Investigations in Washington, where he led an investigation into nationwide organized crime employee benefits fraud scheme. Mike knows fraud when he sees it. And of course, that is very useful in his present job here in San Diego. Much to the chagrin of many local officials, he was elected San Diego's city attorney in December 2004. During his campaign for city attorney, he promised that if elected, he would be the city's attorney for all the people rather than the city council. He promised to shake things up in the city if he was elected. And I think we can all attest to the fact that he has fulfilled that promise. Mike, we all thank you for taking time to be with us, our Osher Institute today, and we welcome you to our distinguished lecture series.
Good morning. Thank you. You know, when I became city attorney back in December of 2004, I decided to take a low-key approach. And since then, I've tried to be a person of few words and to focus on making sure that the people of San Diego knew what was taking place at city government. City government, like all government, is supposed to serve the needs of the people within the democracy to solve the problems that individuals cannot solve on their own. And so we come together and we pool our money and we organize systems to provide transportation, to provide wastewater systems, water systems, streets and roads, basic safety, basic recreation with our rec centers, our 53 rec centers, our 39,000 acres of parks. We also provide libraries for people that want to continue their learning and don't have the resources to maintain and equip their own personal libraries, giving people an opportunity, allowing people to enjoy their lives and find ways to live out their lives in retirement. I know many of you here are not yet in your retirement years. But when you get ready to retire, I hope that you'll have libraries that you can visit. Now, what happened in San Diego was that sometime around 1996, the city government, under the Golding administration, there was a takeover. That's maybe the best way to say it. There was a takeover of city government by special interests, but also by a very destructive way of thinking. In 1996, Mayor Susan Golding was serving out her term as mayor based on the philosophy that you could increase city services without increasing the revenues to pay for those services. It's okay to take a position that you don't want to increase taxes, but then you have to take a position not to increase the services because you don't have the money to pay for them. In 1996 and in 1997, the city committed, through Susan Golding, to give the San Diego Chargers owners a $173 million contract. In other words, the city obligated itself to pay $173 million over a 30-year period to increase the seating capacity of Qualcomm and to build skyboxes and to build club seats so that the owners of the professional football team could make more money. In addition, the city agreed to the ticket guarantee. And this was really, when you think about it, a remarkable intervention into the marketplace by government in violation of all of the market intervention rules. When we think about market intervention, when the government steps into a situation to provide some kind of government program or some government subsidy, that usually is because of a market failure. At least that's what they taught us at Harvard. They said that the reason the government intervenes is because there's a breakdown in the market. But in 1996, there was no breakdown in the NFL market. They were making more money then than they had ever made. But there was the ability to manipulate the public opinion and to work the mayor and the council and to get the city to sign on to a contract that obligated the city to pay $173 million over the next 30 years, but no money was provided for it. Also in 1996, Susan Golding and her administration negotiated contracts with the labor unions, which really was predicated on a remarkable set of decisions. The first decision was to increase pension benefits dramatically by giving retroactive benefits to people that for years they'd already worked, to increase what their benefits were for those years, to allow the workforce to purchase 12.5% to 15% of their last year's salary in pension by buying pension credits, by buying years of service. There's now been 17,000 years of service purchased. By creating something called the DROP program that allowed you to retire and receive your retirement benefit while still working for the city and you receive your salary, plus 8%, plus 3%, plus 2%, plus what they call the 13th check. That was supposed to be cost neutral. The purchase of service program was supposed to be cost neutral. Now, when they did that, when Mayor Golding did that and the pension board did that, decided to increase benefits, they also decided to decrease contributions. So not only did they not do what they should have done, which is if they were going to provide the benefits, not only what they should have done was to increase revenues, but they actually decided to decrease the contributions into the pension system. So we pass over at that point from a policy choice to what is essentially a fraud. Because what you're doing is you're creating obligations on the part of the city, but you're leaving it to future taxpayers to pay those obligations and to come up with ways and means of paying those obligations. And that's where we are right now, is that we are here now trying to deal with what was done in 1996. But there's one other thing that they did. They suspended the rules of arithmetic. Literally. Part of the deal was that the city agreed and the pension board agreed that arithmetic would not be used to calculate how much the benefits cost and how much the contributions were going to be reduced. Because the arithmetic is normally done for a pension plan by an actuary. And the actuary utilizes arithmetic to add up how much money has to be contributed each year to keep a pension plan sound by keeping a balance between assets and liabilities. So the decision to enter into this agreement, which was called Manager's Proposal 1, which resulted in increased benefits, decreased contributions, and a suspension of the rules of arithmetic, that decision was not a policy choice. That was an illegal act. One, because it created a massive debt without a vote of the public, which was required under our state constitution and our state charter. And two, because the people that were doing it on the pension board and the people that were getting the council to do it were all personally benefiting from it, which is a violation of prohibited financial interests. When an individual who is a public official has a contractual interest in the contract that they're negotiating on behalf of the government, they lose their power to bind you. And the reason for that was because in the past that was done both in terms of creating debt without a vote of the people as well as these prohibited financial interests. That was done in the past, in our past history, going all the way back to one of the original cases, which was a famous case called the Yazoo case. You know, have you ever heard you know, up the Yazoo without a paddle? Well, the Yazoo case had to do with the Georgia legislature giving interests in large tracts of land near the Yazoo River to special individuals who then gave it back to the legislators, which was really, you know, just a polite thing to do. And what was interesting is they did that, and then the public found out about it, and the next year the legislature was recalled, and the law that was passed originally by the legislators was repealed, and the original law, they had a big meeting out in the public square, and they literally burned the first law. That's what I'd like to do with MP1, Manager's Proposal 1. I mean, hopefully we'll be able to do that. Now, unfortunately, though, the story gets worse. Remember, we have the $173 million for the expansion of Qualcomm. Then we have the hundreds of millions of dollars of new benefits, decreasing contributions by hundreds of millions of dollars, and the suspension of arithmetic. Then what happens is we then get to the downtown ballpark in 2000, a few years later. Now, the original deal on the ballpark was that the ballpark owner, the ball team owner, was supposed to see to it that 2,000 new hotel rooms were built, and that was going to generate more tax revenue, what they call TOT revenue, and that was to be used to pay for the costs of the ballpark, the amortization. Mayor Murphy, right at the last moment, pressured by the Union Tribune, which I'll be talking about very shortly, I'm very excited to see that, I don't know if you've read the paper today, but they've decided to repackage the news. I don't know if you noticed that. I want to tell them it's not the packaging of the news that's the problem. It's not the form of the packaging. It is the lack of reliability of what is being packaged that is the problem. But we'll come back to them. So anyway, so now we're into 2000, and unfortunately, right at the last moment, Mayor Murphy makes a decision, starting in 2000 and eventually it goes over to 2002, but he makes a decision to change the financing for the downtown ballpark, and the city, under his leadership, assumed hundreds of millions of dollars of new liability for the downtown ballpark with no new taxes. And of course, you know, the newspaper again, as they did with the ballpark or the football expansion, you know, encouraged the city council to do that. And I might also add, in 1996, we had the Republican convention here in San Diego, which the city subsidized, and there was no taxes raised for that either. That was clearly above $6 million. So you see the pattern here. We don't raise taxes, but we spend lots of money, hundreds of millions of dollars of money. So we have the original $173 million for the football, probably $300 to $500 million for the increased pension benefits that we didn't provide for, and then a couple hundred million dollars for the ballpark, all of which is earning interest. Now, once they got done with the 2002 debt for the new ballpark, they then went into a new round of negotiations with the labor unions, and once again gave hundreds of millions of dollars of new benefits to the labor unions, and decreased contributions again. You're starting to see a pattern here? And that was in 2002. Now, once they got done with the 2002 thing with regard to the new round of pension benefits that were unpaid for, then they went right into negotiations with the Chargers and entered into a new agreement where they extended the ticket guarantee, which was essentially a rent reduction feature, from the third game of the 2007 season all the way out to 2020 at an additional cost of $75 million to taxpayers if the Chargers stay here to 2020. So that's where we are today, is that it wasn't so much that you could have a quarrel with the fact that you didn't want to raise new taxes. You could do that. You could make that argument. But what they did is, while they were saying they weren't going to raise new taxes, they spent money that they didn't have, all of which earns interest. So the pension plan has, I think, a deficit of about probably close to $1.5 billion. So imagine 8% on that before you even pay this year's cost of the pension. You know, it's a sizable amount of money. Last year, the pension liabilities went from $6 billion to $6.5 billion. The entire city general fund budget's only $1 billion. Now, how did the city officials who benefited from this? So you have two groups that are benefiting. You have the corporate sports folks that are benefiting, and then you have the insider union management people that are benefiting, because when I say unions, municipal unions, what I also mean to include is all of the managers, the entire management of the city, when they negotiated benefit increases with the unions, they also received those benefits themselves. So guess how tough they were in those negotiations? Not very tough. Now, what did they do to hide all of this? Well, one of the things they did is they hired a very small CPA firm to do the city's audits. They prepared false documents and false reports, and you don't have to take my word for it. The Securities and Exchange Commission last year found that San Diego had engaged in the largest municipal securities fraud in American history because they hid all this. They then, when it became so huge that they couldn't even hide it anymore, you couldn't count that high, to put all the debt in and to show all the different nuances of the fraud, that then resulted in us as a city being unable to issue financial statements for the last 5 years. Think about that. The city of San Diego has not had a financial statement since 2001. And this is 2007. Now it gets worse. It gets worse. So as San Diego was reeling, the same people that had basically been in control were trying to figure out how to continue to bamboozle the people of San Diego. One little thing that happened was that I got elected, which kind of messed things up a little bit. And the reason I say that is because I actually meant what I said, that I was going to go in and represent the interests of the people of San Diego and make sure they knew what was going on. And no one believed that. And when I first got there, very shortly after I got there, I had breakfast with the city manager. And he told me that whether I had security or not, would depend on how I acted. So I must be doing the right thing because I haven't had security since then. And there was an enormous effort to try to completely disrupt the city attorney's office by people in the office who had been a part of the scheme, who had benefited from it, who had looked the other way, who had issued legal opinions, and who had seen the role of the city attorney's office as finding camouflage and helping to come up with excuses to hide what was going on. And the mayor was in the thick of it, Mayor Murphy. He was a part of it. He had passed on these things. He had made the mistakes. And he was definitely into, in my judgment, an all-out cover-up to try to hide everything. Now, unfortunately for him, the SEC and the U.S. Attorney's Office were investigating it. So the first thing that they did is they hired Enron's lawyers, Vincent and Elkins, to come in and conduct an investigation. That cost $6 million, and they found that basically no one did anything wrong. For $3 million, they would have found somebody did something wrong. Well, KPMG, which unfortunately it was found to be the largest operator of criminal tax shelters in American history and had to pay almost a $1 billion penalty, they are also our auditors. So I can't wait until we get their audit opinion. That'll make a big impression, I'm sure. And I don't mean to put down KPMG because they're a good firm, and I don't mean to, but they did have this problem because what they did is they objected to the V&E report, the Vincent and Elkins report, as inadequate, that it really didn't uncover and really assess who was responsible. Because what under the audit rules, if you have a city government or a corporation that produces the kind of dishonest results, they trace that back and say, well, you know, dishonest results are usually the result of dishonest people, so you've got to get rid of the dishonest people so that we can then say that you have a reliable system of internal controls that we can rely upon because people are going to be buying your bonds and they're going to want to know that you're in fact telling us what your financial situation is, so we have to know that you're reliable. Well, Vincent and Elkins really didn't help out. KPMG said, no, that investigation was inadequate. And so the next thing they did, when I say they, I mean Mayor Murphy and Lamont Yule and the certain members of the council who all of, you know, were trying to say there's not a problem. They were continuing to try to cover things up. It was really extraordinary because you had the very unusual situation of a government itself that was a Ponzi scheme that engaged in a pattern of illegal behavior but still had the mantle of government legitimacy and still involved in making decisions and still functioning as a government decision-making group, but they were under investigation, you know, by the federal government as well. So it's a very unique situation to have, you know, one government agency investigating another government agency. And unless, you know, so, but the people that were under investigation, the city government, they were very expert in hiring lawyers to try to continue to hide the ball. So then that brought in the great Arthur Levitt, the former head of the SEC. And he basically picked up where the Vincent Elkins people left off, but he had a whole different kind of roadshow. He was Elmer Gantry plus. He went to the Union Tribune, and his job was supposedly to come in and assess whether the city attorney's report, which found that there was reckless and knowing fraud by certain members of the council and certain other city officials, and I had issued that report in February of 2005, having been a securities fraud attorney, having had access to the inside information in the city about who knew what, internal decision records and things of that sort of the council, that was in the, they showed the council had been told about these problems and that they were basically covering them up. And so I issued my report in February of 2005, and then the following year, Vincent Elkins was hired, Crowe was hired to say, was I right or was Vincent and Elkins right? And then from there, this firm realized how vulnerable the city was and how vulnerable our city council and our mayor were. And so they played on those vulnerabilities to extend their contract out to the point where they charged $20 million, half of which went to KPMG's lawyers, Wilkie Farr, and the other half went to Arthur Levitt and his firm, Kroll. And then when they got done, they didn't answer any questions either. I mean, they answered a few questions, but they didn't answer the central questions. And their report, which we will be issuing a report That's how crazy this is. We're now issuing reports on the reports. But their report really didn't get the job done. And what it did is it was a very political document. And then they got out of town. And that cost us $20 million. So we had the $6 million for Vincent Elkins, the $20 million for Kroll, all the way back to when this first started in 1996. So what you have is you have first the first fraud, and then you have the cover-up and the manipulation of the first fraud by the people who are still running the show, who participated to some degree or greater or lesser degree in the original fraud. So that didn't work out. Now, KPMG had said, well, once we get that Vincent and Elkins report, then you'll get your audit. That was 6 months ago, the Kroll report. That was 6 months ago that Kroll issued their report. And we still don't have the audit. And the audit is nowhere in sight. And we've now spent $6 million on KPMG. So now what's happening is the professionals are exploiting our situation. And because certain members of our council don't want to admit that we did something wrong or they did something wrong, they've been going along with it. Mayor Sanders has been trying to manage the situation to clean it up. Meanwhile, the unions are completely and totally dominated by lawyers that made the original decisions and other leaders that made the original decisions to enter into all these bad deals. Now, I happen to be pro-labor, and I consider myself a Robert Kennedy Democrat. Okay, so and I've always been that way. I first got involved in politics through when Robert Kennedy ran in 68. So I look at this from the point of view of labor union leadership has to be reformed because there's no way that the public will ever support this kind of behavior where the unions become dominating in the governance and controlling the government as opposed to just representing their members, and they're actually dictating policy and running the city for their benefit. And that's what's happened. There's been a takeover of your government. And there's been a takeover of your government by the leadership of these unions that control all the employees. They negotiate with the city council members, the collective bargaining agreements. The firefighters put up those helmets that tell you vote for so-and-so. People think, oh, they must be pro-firefighter programs or, you know, let's put out the fires. But no, what they are is they're pro, let's keep rigging the system. Now, that's where we are today. Mayor Sanders, 2 days ago, joined with me in calling for the absolute elimination of the DROP program as one of the first steps. The DROP program. The DROP program is the program I talked to you about that was negotiated in 1996 that was supposed to be cost neutral, that allowed someone to enter into the DROP program, continue to work for the city, they get their city salary and they get their retirement check at the same time. They get 8% per year, 2% cost of living, 3% match if they're safety, and what's the 13th check, which is an added bonus check. All that goes into their DROP account for 5 years. Some of them, when they retire, you know, get hundreds of thousands of dollars. Our actuary has said that's going to cost up to $400 million. So instead of it being cost neutral, it's actually costing a massive amount of money. It was a requirement that it be cost neutral. The study that was supposed to be done by the city was never done. And it wasn't done because the people that were controlling the city were going to benefit from the DROP program. Or that because they didn't want to blow the whistle on another boondoggle. Now, the mayor of San Diego had the courage to join with the city attorney and say, no one else gets to enter into the DROP program. We want to end that program right now. And that's what we have to do. And we're trying to do that by going to the council, by bringing it up in our settlement negotiations today with the judge, and by doing it as well in collective bargaining. The other thing that we've come out in favor of is on purchase of service credits. People bought credits, 17,000 years of pension credits. And 17,000 years, what that means is, if it means 17,000 times 2.5% of the last year's salary. In some cases, it's 3%. So just do the math. 17,000 times either 2.5 or 3.0 times the last year's salary. And the cost of those service credits were substantially below what their real cost should have been. And that was something that was done intentionally by the pension board. So the original deal was, yeah, if you want to buy a service credit and pay the actual value, that's fine, but that's not what was done. So we've called for those purchase of service credits to be marked down to actual value. So that it's about $110 million or more as of right now that it'll save us. On the health care, retiree health care. Right now, everyone that's retired gets up to $7,000. And every year, whatever the actuary for the Treasury Department says that health care has gone up, we have to match that up to 10%. So right now, and all of that is, most of that, I won't say all, much of that is run through the unions. So we just transfer the money to the unions, and then they go out and negotiate the deals. And in one of the primary one, the person who does that is the son of the union boss who runs the union. See what I mean? And here's the thing. Every year or every 2 years or every 3 years, the unions come back for more. They renegotiate. They come back for more. They come back for more. And so what you have, and then the people that are serving on the pension board are serving on these other committees who are city insiders, they have so rigged the system and so organized the parameters of the system that what they've done is they've created this massive liability machine that generates benefits for them that we as taxpayers, you as taxpayers, have to pay for, but the asset machine is very small. So right now, if you want to think about it, the city government of San Diego is primarily a Social Security department for its employees. They get dental, eye, you know, right down the line, and they get it for life. They get the drop. They can have a 401k. They get the SPSP. They have a savings plan. And so think about what they've done. They've used their power to create a cornucopia of benefits for themselves. Now, the current plan is to shrink the libraries, shrink the rec centers, sell our property in a futile effort to try to come up with enough money to finance the Ponzi scheme without really looking at the arithmetic. So one of the revolutionary things that I've come out in favor of is the use of arithmetic. Okay? Not since, that's a revolutionary, and that's the other thing. The reason I'm seen as a revolutionary is because I have taken the position that city government should exist for the sole and single purpose of advancing the long-term welfare of the people of San Diego. And that is a revolutionary Che Guevara, Fidel Castro type thought at city government. That's how absurd it is. Albert Camus could come to San Diego and have written his last novel called The Absurdity, San Diego by the Sea. We're going to change all that. What we're going to do and what we are doing is we're going to restructure the entire government and restructure that debt. We're bringing in some of the best people in the country that have been actively involved in that, someone that was involved, people that have done this kind of restructuring before. We're trying to use the framework of the Pension Protection Act, which was a new law passed last year to deal with the private pension problem, because the Pension Guarantee Corporation has had to deal with the fact that they went from a $9 billion surplus to a $21 billion deficit because of at-risk pension plans. And what they basically say is you have 7 years. If you have an at-risk pension plan, you have 7 years. You've got to shed excessive benefits. You've got to raise revenues. You've got to have honesty in the way that you report your unfunded liability, and you have to have clear management of the problem, which we don't have. In San Diego, right now, the foxes are still in charge of the hen house because you have the unions and the Murphy appointees still dominating the management of the pension system. Under the charter, I'm supposed to be the attorney for the pension system. I'm supposed to name the attorney. But I haven't been permitted to do that. They've been able to thwart the charter so far and keep me from being able to do that. Had I been able to do that, then we could have, I think, made real progress on this, because you have to have a friendly attorney to go along with that. And you see, in 1931, when the independent city attorney was created by the vote of the people, the reason that was they did that is they said, look, we're not so much concerned about the various conflicts amongst the city officials. What we're concerned about is the conflict between the city officials and the public. So what we'll do is the public names who the attorney is. Because if any one of these groups that's within the government names the attorney, then that's who the attorney will work for. But if the public names the attorney, then we'll know that we'll be represented in all these different components of the city. That was the genius of 1931. I personally think we should do that with the auditor. I think that we ought to have an independent elected auditor. And I also think that we ought to have an independent elected charter commission like they did in 29 and 31. Because then, and the people that are in government shouldn't be the ones that are redefining the government while they're actually in office. I think that's a mistake, and I think an elected, nor their appointees, I think an elected charter commission is the way to go. I don't have much hope for that. My own approach has been to try and to stay totally focused on the problem and the solutions to the problems. And it's amazing, how... And I want to now talk about the Union Tribune. I think I'm about out of time for my thing, but it's a good place to finish up. The problem with the Union Tribune is that it is run by a group of politicians. And I don't mean that in to be, biting or to reduce them to some kind of vicious abstraction. But they literally are politicians. They're very closely aligned with the Conservative Party here in San Diego, but a certain element of that Conservative Party, which I'll call the Special Interest Party. Their idea of a housing problem is to find a new stadium for the Chargers as opposed to new housing for the poor. That's what they think the biggest housing problem is. They have been losing. I sometimes say that what they've done in their management and personnel is the opposite of what I've done. I've let people go in the city attorney's office in order to bring about change. They have let people go in order to maintain the status quo. How could you let Don Bowder go? They did. How could you let Neil Morgan go? They did. How could you let James Goldsboro go? They did. How about Phil Lavelle, who's now the press secretary for Dianne Feinstein, who they were underutilizing? And the reason for that is this. The way that the Union Tribune works, and I have been probably in the Union Tribune as much as any human being alive, but the way that they work is like this. The editorial page creates the truth. And the news page confirms the truth as revealed by the editorial page. It's kind of like a religious thing. You see what I mean? Like, for example, We paneled the audit committee the other day, made up of three members of the city council. That was something that the city attorney's office suggested in 2005. It was not something that Kroll suggested. They wanted a completely different kind of audit committee. The Union Tribune reports the other day, the city council impaneled the new audit committee. They had their first meeting and fulfilled one of the objectives of the fulfilled one of the directives of the Kroll report. Now, why did they do that? Because their editorial page got into bed with Arthur Levitt because they were impressed by his glitter. And Bob Kittle got into a relationship with Mr. Kroll, and so Mr. Levitt, and so the truth, a la Arthur Levitt, became the truth a la the editorial page. Well, unfortunately, the Kroll report turned out to be a bomb. And the suggestions, there are some good ones, but the core suggestions really are irrelevant or not well thought out, not really geared to the specifics of our needs. And so it became an embarrassment. Rather than admit it, the news side keeps trying to breathe life into the dead patient, to this dead carcass. And I don't say that to be mean or anything. I'm not saying that to be mean. What I'm saying is this. I think the biggest reason that we're in the trouble we're in right now is the Union Tribune has let the people of San Diego down because they are not a reliable source of information. And when I think about the Union Tribune, and I'll finish on this and I'll take your questions, this is what I think about. Because in a way, we're all responsible. I was reading the other day about Martin Luther King and his work that he did at the Dexter Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. And I have to tell you that at some parts of this, and I'm not an emotional person in this sense, but some parts of this, the old eyes got a little watery there, and I'll tell you why. Here's a young Martin Luther King in his 20s. He gets in his car in Atlanta, and he's driving down to Montgomery, Alabama, to think about becoming the pastor at the Dexter Baptist Church. And he's listening to the opera that's being broadcast on the radio from the Met. Okay? And he's telling the story in his book, and he's going to school in Boston, where he's not having to face segregation and discrimination. So he has the courage to leave his safe home in Atlanta, where his dad had, had a following and a base. And he drives down to Dexter, and he eventually becomes the pastor, and he eventually becomes the president of the Montgomery Improvement Association, the MIA. And then they basically, when Rosa Parks refuses to move, the MIA is formed, he's the president, and they come together, and they decide the 14,000 African Americans that live in Montgomery that ride the buses are not going to ride the buses. But Martin Luther King explains, he says, I'm worried about the boycott because this is what the White Citizens Council does. This is what they have done. They have withdrawn, they boycotted people that were sympathetic to the African Americans, and I don't want to use their tactics. And he was concerned about it, and he thought about it, and this is what led him to researching Gandhi and researching, and what he came up with this, he said, we're not really boycotting. What we're doing is we're building on a fundamental principle that non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral duty as cooperation with good. And every time an African American in Montgomery, Alabama, put that 10 cents in the coin collection machine on the bus and went into that bus knowing that there was a system where they had to move to the back of the bus or give up their seat to a white person, they were participating in an evil system. And when I was reading that, I was thinking to myself, I just had this visual, because I do this many mornings, of putting those two quarters in the slots to buy the Union Tribune. And I was thinking, this morning, non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as cooperation with good. We're financing the only newspaper, the monopoly newspaper, knowing that it is not serving the interest. And I'm not talking about controlling the editorial content. If they want to be pro, one side of the equation, they have a perfect right to do that. But what they don't have a right to do is to hold themselves out as a newspaper and present something as news when what they're really doing is manipulating the public to serve their envelope journalism. And what I mean by that is they get behind the professional sports and this thing or that thing where they have a financial interest in it, and then they push that as truth, and they manipulate us. So every time when you write out those checks to the Union Tribune next time, or you go to the thing, I want you to, I'm not asking you to boycott them. I'm not saying that. I just want you to ask yourself this question. Would Martin Luther King be proud? Or would he tell you, when you're putting that money in the slots, non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral duty as cooperation with good? Thank you. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Mr. Aguirre.
Yes.
After hearing your description of our dysfunctional city government, why not just declare bankruptcy and have an outside person put our house in order? Could you please kind of go through the, in your opinion, the pros and cons of that approach?
Well, I think that we have to have reorganization, and this is government, a democracy, and I would prefer to have the people get involved, particularly in the 2008 election, but I would prefer to have, and I think it would be better in the long run, to have the people step in and put new people in, and for us to use our own resources and our own accountability to solve the problems. When you go to bankruptcy court, it's not a panacea. I'm not saying that we would never have to get there, and I've never taken that off the table. But basically what bankruptcy court allows you to do is to have a forum in which to try to solve these problems. Right now, we have created a forum. In fact, we'll be going to our first session, substantive session, with the settlement judge by bringing the cases to set aside the illegal benefits. Judge Barton has ordered that settlement negotiations take place. The unions have declined to participate, but the pension board is participating, and so we think that we can make progress with the pension board on the getting rid of the drop program and on reducing the purchase of service credits to actual value and to reinstating the city attorney as the attorney for the pension. So we're going to start that process today, and we're hopeful that Judge Einhorn can, in essence, create a forum for problem solving, and that's what bankruptcy basically does. In bankruptcy, we would have to pay all of the lawyers' fees for all the players, and that would be enormously expensive. And in addition, we don't have a city council yet that is united in so that in coming forward, you know, in bankruptcy, you usually have a united management with a plan, and the bankruptcy court assists in organizing the creditors and in disciplining the process to allow the plan to go forward. It'd be difficult for us to get a one single comprehensive plan right now because of the division, you know, as you have seen, between the mayor and the council and the city attorney and certain council members. And so what I have tried over the last 2 years is to create this forum that is a kind of forum that I used when I was in practice, in private practice, to try to solve these kinds of problems. Pat Shea, who is the primary advocate of bankruptcy, is a very close associate of mine. He counsels me on a daily basis. So I understand the arguments on bankruptcy. Right now, I'd like to try to exhaust all other avenues. If we had to go into reorganization in federal court, we'd have to show that we have, in fact, tried to exhaust all these other avenues anyway. The biggest obstacle we face today is that certain council members do not want to admit that there's a problem and have been unwilling to basically take a strong stand with the unions to get rid of these improper benefits. We're making progress on that, and I have keep an eye on things. We may have to get into bankruptcy. It's not. I don't think we're at that point right yet. We do have options.
Michael, yes. I have a soft question for you.
Okay. Well, and by the way, don't be afraid. I know that there may be some out there that are not, you know, completely enthusiastic about me, and it's okay. You can ask any questions you want. I'm used to the abuse. Go ahead.
Mike, a lot of people say that they agree with your goals and agree what you're trying to accomplish.
Right.
But you are a disruptive influence in the city, that you're a loose cannon, that you can't get along with people, that the city attorney's office is in chaos. You hire people and you fire people and
this
so
is
forth.
This is a soft question. Thank you. I'm basking in the glow of this question. Hold on.
Are they talking about somebody else, or is that you?
Well, you know, I like to think, first of all, I may be a cannon, but I'm not loose, okay? You know, here's the unfortunate thing. In some ways, it's like being in a bomber, you know, flying over a target, and you have to take a certain amount of flack that comes with the territory. So I accept that. But let's go through the city attorney's office. Karen Heumann and Catherine Burton are the two women that basically run the administrative hiring side of the office. And basically our philosophy was everybody in the office has a chance to stay. Every attorney, 150 attorneys, you all have a chance to stay. But what has to go is the attitude that you don't serve the public. The attitude that your job is to make excuses for the council members and the staff here to rip off the public, that those days are gone. When we have contracts, we're going to review the contracts to make sure that taxpayers' interests are protected. When we look at land development, we're going to make sure that the environmental impact reports are done correctly. When you have meetings, we're not going to let you have closed meetings if the public, in fact, has a right to participate. If you build a building in the middle of the flight path of an airport, you know, we're going to make you take it down below where the FAA, to the point where the FAA says it's necessary. Well, the overwhelming majority of the attorneys that worked in the office could not accept that. They could not accept it because, remember, they had been a part of this system. And one of the departments that is set to receive a big chunk of these massive benefits are the attorneys. The attorneys had to sign off on MP1. The attorneys had to sign off on Manager's Proposal 1. They had to sign off on the Charger deal. They had to sign off on the NTC deal. They had to sign off on the deal with the Chargers and the $173 million and the ticket guarantee and all the other things. And they simply were not willing to change. And so that created a morale problem. And I was able to solve the morale problem. And we did it systematically. This is what we did. We took every department, and we worked our way through the department, and we put out ads. And let me tell you, when the word got out that we were 100% committed to the public interest, we had resumes from all over the state. A fellow that was the second in, I think, Riverside City Attorney's Office, who was an official in the Duke Majan administration, absolutely brilliant lawyer by the name of Houston Carlisle, he came in. Don McGrath, who used some profanities inappropriately and unfortunately, but who had been a lead partner in Baker & McKenzie, he came in. USD law school helped us and brought over their crackerjack people in environmental law. And we are providing leadership on global warming, on environmental review, and are doing an excellent job there. Our contract people, same thing. Contracts don't get through anymore that are not in the public's best interest. And so what we did is we systematically reorganized the office. So now we have an army of attorneys who share my philosophy and are committed to the public interest, and we have a fabulous working environment. What you're hearing from are the people that we let go who went to the Union Tribune. And let me tell you something. If you think the Union Tribune was prepared to say nasty things about me before today, I can assure you that after today, and this is basically what happened. Anyone that has something nasty to say about me, go to the UT, they'll put it in the paper. That's basically the way it works. And that's what people knew. They knew that they could try to intimidate and try to keep me from making the changes by doing that. But that hasn't worked. Our office now I have an excellent working relationship with Kevin Faulkner and the chairman of the audit committee. I love Donna Fry, and we are brother and sister. She is a fabulous person, and we work very closely with her. Jerry Sanders, I think, is a great individual. I've spoken to him two or three times since I've even been here this morning. I believe he relies on my counsel, and I know I respect him, and we have a wonderful working relationship. Tony Young, the same thing. Tony Atkins and I are trying to get our relationship moving again. I work very aggressively and diligently in trying to do this. Scott Peters and I, we're not going to get there. I don't believe that he serves the public interest. I don't believe that he's a problem solver. I see him doing nothing but political things. I can't get there with him. But I still never give up hope. If something happens, you know, my job is to try to work as constructively as I can.
As I listen to you and I hear in great detail the horrendous mess that we have in City Hall and your great effort to do correction on it. I'd like to ask what you think the impact might be on property values. And let me caution, not what you wish it would be, but how do you think it's going to impact?
Well, I think if we, I mean, think about this. If you know, one of the big concerns I had that still worries me is the water you drink in La Jolla is not as safe as the water you drink if you live near the Alvarado treatment plant as of today. Our water system is out of date. We're trying to raise the money to pay for that, but right now we have an ozone process that we're not using that would improve the health of the water. Our pipes are in disrepair or in need of replacement, and the same is true of wastewater. And I think that what happens is as this problem goes unresolved, and as we don't maintain the basic services like our streets, for example, which are really in bad shape, there will eventually be an erosion of our infrastructure to the point that it will affect property values. And that's why it's so imperative that we act. We don't want, you know, it's like, you know how I let this little leak in my roof go for a while, you know, because I kept forgetting, you know, when it didn't rain. And the next thing I realized is that I had to repair a big section of the roof as a result of it. And I wouldn't have had to have done that had I just immediately repaired it. That's where we are right now. The cost of repairing our water system and wastewater system is much more expensive now because we've delayed it. And we've delayed it because some of the money was spent that should have been spent on things like that to make up for the shortfall in the city. Money was spent out of water and wastewater for employees for pension benefits that were excessive. And so I think that eventually it could have an it will have an impact, and that's why it's imperative. Every single San Diegan needs to be personally informed. You know, during the Depression, there was an enormous knowledge on the part of the rank-and-file citizen about the economy. And I'm not saying that there was agreement, but there was an enormous amount of knowledge. And one of the ways that people got information was through the fireside chats of FDR, like the bank, the closing down of banks, the bank holiday that was used in order to get the banks back on their feet. And that's one of the things we have to do. Is this is a serious crisis that we're in right now. This is a serious crisis. It will eventually have an impact not only on land values, but it will have an impact on employment. It will have an impact certainly. I mean, think about it. We don't have a financial statement for 5 years. That is totally destroying our reputation, or at least has the potential of totally destroying our reputation on Wall Street.